We're studying tonight from Luke, the 15th chapter. So if you'd open your Bibles to that, I don't know how far we'll get, but I would like to, if it's possible. We'll see. We may have to break it into two sections, but I think it would be good if we could deal with the whole chapter in one section, but we'll see how that plays out. We know that Jesus is, in this context, a rather lengthy context, as it were, Luke chapter 13, 14, and so forth. But in this 15th chapter, I want to call your attention to Jesus eating with the publicans and sinners. We introduced this last time, and we noted in verse 1, "Now all the publicans and sinners were drawing near unto him to hear him, and both the Pharisees and the scribes murmured, saying, This man receiveth sinners and eateth with them." Those two verses set the stage for the things that are discussed in these next several verses that express the Lord's care for those who are lost. Now, certainly when we talk about the publicans and the sinners that Jesus is concerned about, we know that the publicans were a despised people because they were the tax collectors. And often they embezzled the tax money and put money in their pocket, charging more money than the taxes were. And so they were despised by the populace. And then the sinners, that's a rather general or broad category. We might include in that those that were considered the least of the least as far as their practices were concerned. And the Pharisees and the scribes are set in opposing these who are described as publicans and sinners. We noted last week that the Pharisees were the strictest sect among the Jews, often making laws where none had been made to appear more righteous. We note that Jesus rebuked them over and over again in Matthew chapter 23, referring to them as hypocrites. Associated with them were the scribes. The scribes were those who were the, I will call them lawyers. I don't know if that was an official title necessarily, but those who were teachers of the law, because they made copies of the law, and doing so they became more and more familiar with it. And so they were the teachers among the Jews along with the Pharisees. Now, they're murmuring. That in itself ought to draw our attention. We noticed in the Old Testament text that murmuring is just a bad thing. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, the illustration of the Old Testament is cited, "Neither murmur ye, as some of them murmured and perished by the destroyer." And so what we see is they're just fussing. And their murmuring is, "This man eateth, receiveth sinners and eateth with them." Now that's their criticism. Their argument might have had some merit if Jesus had acted in any way that would lend credence to the practices of the publicans and the sinners. But he did not. He didn't participate in the things that were wrong, and there's certainly no indication that he granted a rubber stamp to the things that were wrong. But what we do know is he is associating himself with these who need to be taught. Now, we've noted earlier that Jesus was rebuked, and he pointed out that the folks who are well have no need of a physician. Those who are sick do, and so Jesus is associating himself with these in order that he might teach them. We left off on this last point, I believe, on this chart, of the definition of a Pharisee. The word Pharisee means separatist, and that's just exactly how they saw themselves. They were not only separate from others, but they considered themselves on a pedestal up above some of the others. And as we had noted, they sometimes set themselves not only on a pedestal, but do as I say, not as I do kind of thing, and Jesus therefore rebuked them for being hypocrites. Now, when these accuse Jesus of receiving sinners and eateth with them, I learned something this week. That was not just an isolated incident. That was somewhat of a common occurrence with the disciples' association with those that were not approved by the Pharisees. The Pharisees tried to persuade the general populace that Jesus' credibility is destroyed. You don't need to listen to him because look at who he's associated with. And we talk about politics today. Guilt by association. Not anything new. It's not anything new. Jesus did not, as we mentioned, imply that the conduct of the publicans and sinners was in any way approved. And of course these Old Testament passages point out that what they were doing was wrong. These New Testament passages, when we look at 1 Corinthians 5, the practice of a long laundry list of things, are certainly disapproved. Now, that brings us to the illustrations that Jesus uses, and I want to spend just a moment talking about them. Let's read, first of all, verses 3 through verse 7, shall we? Verse 3 through verse 7. He spake unto them this parable, saying, What man of you, having 100 sheep, and having lost one of them, doth not leave the 99 in the wilderness, and go after that which is lost, until he find it? And when he hath found it, he layeth it on his shoulders, rejoicing. And when he cometh home, he calleth together his friends and his neighbors, saying unto them, Rejoice with me, for I found my sheep which was lost. I say unto you that even so there shall be joy in heaven over one sinner that repenteth more than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Now we're all familiar with that, right? Everybody in this class, we've read that over and over and over and over. We note that Jesus is talking about a man that had 100 sheep. Here's a man who is a shepherd. And what does he do? He leaves the 99 and goes to find the one that is lost. Now, sheep are funny things. They're funny creatures. I don't have a whole lot of knowledge personally about sheep, but Beth and Jason, as some of you may know, they had several sheep on their property, and I've heard a lot of stories, not only from them, but others who have some familiarity with sheep. And from what I understand, sheep are not the brightest children in the crowd, not the brightest color in the box, so to speak. But what I understand about sheep, two is sometimes they get involved in something that may very well hazard their life. They have no knowledge of it. Have no knowledge at all of it. And when you look at this sheep, he's lost. He's lost in the wilderness. Now, I think sometimes when we talk about a shepherd feeding the sheep, I saw a deal a while back that was discussing that at some length. And the provisions of the shepherd, how that he provides, so to call it, green pastures for his sheep. It's not a hay field full of alfalfa. It might be a rocky slope where there's a sprig of grass every once in a while, and he has to know how to find it because the sheep do what to grass? They eat all of it. They pull it up by the roots. They eat everything. So he has to keep moving to find the green pastures, so to speak. And in that part of the country, there was not a whole lot. Now, if a sheep gets over here where he's separated from the flock, separated from the shepherd, you see the obvious peril that he places himself in. He may not be able to find anything to eat. He might not be able to find anything to drink. And certainly he places himself in danger from the wolves or the coyotes in this part of the country, so to speak. And so he's in danger. Now, question. Does that sheep know all that? Has he put that into his little calculator and figured out just how much danger he might be in? No, he don't know he's lost. He don't know that. He doesn't understand the danger or the peril that he has placed himself in. Now, this figure of the shepherd and the sheep, we've looked at it a number of times in the New Testament, in particular just recently in John chapter 10. And Jesus identified himself as the good shepherd. We read in Acts chapter 20 of the Apostle Paul speaking with those Ephesian elders, talking about their responsibility as shepherds to tend the flock and so forth. So this is a familiar illustration. And when you look at the flock is described as a multitude of people. But what we want to note here is in Matthew 9 and so forth, in Matthew 9 in particular, Jesus looked upon the people and said they were scattered like sheep having no shepherd. All the elements that we've talked about, the lack of something to eat, the lack of water, the lack of oversight, the lack of provision for their safety, and all of those elements come into play when there is no shepherd. Now this sheep has separated himself from the flock, so he doesn't have the benefit of the shepherd. He's in peril. He doesn't know that he's in peril. And the text tells us that the Lord said that the shepherd left the 99 and went to find that which was lost. Now, if you've read any material on this, you know that there are those who like to speculate, right? Keep in mind, this is a parable. Jesus is telling a story.
And I get aggravated sometimes with folks that want to fill in all the details and speculate and think they've got all the answers to things that really not even questions of, that have been asked. Some say, well, this man left the 99. He's taking care of the 99. Irrelevant to the point. That's not the point of the story. The point of the story that Jesus is telling is the man's care for that which was lost. Don't we see that? Let's not burden the parable with questions that haven't been introduced, haven't been asked, and they're certainly not answered, so all you can do is just speculate. We're not interested in that. What we're interested in is here's a man who is responsible for these sheep, and he realizes the value of just one. One means something. Now, if this one can wander off and be lost, then what's the danger to the rest? They can do the same thing. So you've got to find him and provide protection for them all. Period. That's the story. Now, the man finds that which was lost and puts it on his shoulders, and he has occasion to rejoice. You see that in verse 5. You'll notice in verse 4 that he looks for it until he finds it. You see due diligence on his part. He don't just look over the hill and he's done. He looks for it until he finds it. And then when he finds it, there is occasion not only for him to rejoice, but when he comes home, he calls together his friends and his neighbors, saying unto them, rejoice with me, for I have found my sheep, which was lost. Now some speculate, what about, he's got the 99? That's beside the point. He's expressing his interest in the one that was lost. Now what we want to look at is the ridicule of the Pharisees and the scribes of the Lord because he's expressing concern for those who are lost. The publicans and the sinners. Now in verse 7, the lesson is in verse 7. I say unto you that even so there shall be joy in heaven over one sinner that repenteth, more than over 99 righteous persons who need no repentance. Now somebody said, well, you mean 99 righteous people? There's no joy or gloating over it. That's not the point. This one was lost, and he's valuable. And now he has been recovered. Now he's saved. What do the angels of heaven do? They rejoice because this one that was lost is now found.
I have two comments from Lynn.
All right.
I missed the timing of them, so I'm not sure they're relevant to this particular
story. All right.
She says, under the old law, were the Jews not required to exhort, encourage, and correct each other?
Yes.
She also says, if they were to minister to people, why was Jesus so criticized for teaching those who needed it?
Keep in mind who he was criticized by. He was criticized by the Pharisees and the scribes who set themselves above these other folks. Now, consistency is a jewel. And one of the things that we know that Jesus rebuked the Pharisees for, and he said it this way, do not as they do, but do what they say, but do not as they do. So let's not fault the Pharisees, at least at this point, with teaching error. What they taught as teachers, they might very well teach it right. But in this illustration, their interest in that which is lost is unbecoming. They don't care. You see, social status was more important to them. I don't know if that answers Lynn's concern or not, but yes, they had a responsibility to each other.
Right. Well, I think that's the idea, is that she's saying that they had a responsibility. They were supposed to realize that, and they shouldn't be criticizing Jesus for doing something that they should have been doing anyway.
Well, no, they should not have been criticizing him, period. That's a fact. But the fact is, too, they were. They were criticizing him, and what we see is the social element. He's eating with these folks that they don't want to have anything to do with. And lest we think that that's just a peculiarity to this text, it's not. James addresses that to those who are Christians in James chapter 2, who were elevating folks on a pedestal because of their appearance. They had on nice clothes and rings on their fingers and such. And a fellow come in poor clothing, you get to stand over there. The rich guy gets to sit over here. Randy?
You mentioned this last week. You mentioned the word sinners. There's a marginal reference that says irreligious Jews.
Yeah.
It makes me imagine what you're describing, that the scribes and the Pharisees, they don't have any interest in irreligious Jews.
No, no.
They look at them like garbage to be thrown out.
Yeah.
Jesus comes along and says, the way to fix irreligious Jews is to make them religious Jews.
Yeah, go teach them.
Teach them. gives them the truth. This is about some God and other things.
Yeah.
They don't want them to learn anything.
A valuable lesson.
Scribes and Pharisees don't want them to learn anything.
No, no. No, we've got our life. We live it this way every day. And that's a disruption. And brethren, let's not get caught in that trap. That's an easy trap to get caught in. These are the folks that we associate with. And so this is our bubble. And these folks, over, we don't have anything to do with them. And when we create a social environment like that, who are we going to teach? We teach folks, and I realize the point, we need to know, all of us need to study, and the Bible's forever relevant, and we need to keep filling our heads with it, But here's a fellow over here that his head's empty. He don't know anything. And because of his clothes, or because of his job, or because of his lack thereof, we don't have anything to do with it. He's beneath us. And he needs the gospel too. Now that's the lesson that Jesus is driving home here, and we're going to see that, especially as we get to the elder brother in this third illustration. Any further comments or questions on that? This lost sheep. Well, let's talk a little bit about the shepherd. You pointed them out already. These leaders are self-righteous. As like I said, Randy, you pointed them out. They are the religious fellows of the group, and so they see these other fellows as of no account. The illustration of the shepherd and his relationship to the sheep is something that's addressed in Ezekiel chapter 34. And I think it's just a powerful illustration. Turn with me to that text. Ezekiel chapter 34. In Ezekiel chapter 34, beginning in verse, I believe it's in verse 7. He says, "Therefore, ye shepherds, hear the word of Jehovah. As I live, saith the Lord Jehovah, surely for as much as my sheep became a prey, and my sheep became food to all the beasts of the field, because there was no shepherd, neither did my shepherds search for my sheep. But the shepherds fed themselves, and they fed not my sheep. Therefore, ye shepherds, hear the word of Jehovah. Thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I am against the shepherds, and I will require my sheep at their hand, and cause them to cease from feeding the sheep, neither shall the shepherd feed themselves any more, and I will deliver my sheep from their mouth, that they may not be food for them. For thus saith the Lord Jehovah, behold, I myself, even I will search for my sheep, and I will seek them out, as a shepherd seeketh out his flock in the day, that he is among his sheep that are scattered abroad. So will I seek out my sheep, and I will deliver them out of all places, whether they have been scattered in the cloudy and dark day. And I will bring them out from the peoples and gather them from the countries, and I will bring them into their own land, and I will feed them with upon the mountains of Israel by the watercourses and all the inhabited places of the country," and so forth. You can read this whole chapter if you would like, but the care of God for his flock is the point that is emphasized in this text. Now, to Lynn's question, I think it's answered here. What we want to note is that they had a responsibility to each other. There were shepherds of Israel. They were to be watching for their brethren, and they were not. And that's what we're seeing here. Does that make sense? Kind of a simple illustration. He told them a parable. Now, beginning in verse 8. Well, this other point, I failed to get that. I want to get that in too. Absorbed in other matters. You've heard the illustration, I'm sure, that the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. Growing up on a farm, that just amazes me to death, how that you can have a field full of just good green pasture and an old cow just turn her head sideways and push you through the fence to eat grass that's on the other side. And why? It's not like she's not cared for on this side, but she's determined to get the grass that's on the other side of the fence. Now, sheep, sometimes they do that. They push the boundaries and they get over there and they're lost because they're absorbed in other things. And frankly, don't we do the same thing? We talked about that sheep not being the brightest color in the box. Sometimes we're not the brightest color in the box either. We've discussed this passage beginning in Luke chapter 14, verse 15, next several verses. We've recently discussed it in this class where the Lord gave a feast and he sent the servant out to invite folks to come, and they all began to make excuse. Remember that? One had bought
a field, another bought five yoke of oxen, another married a wife. Here are things that are right and honorable, as we pointed out in and of themselves, but when we become too absorbed in those things to pay attention to the things that are important, we're lost. That's like the sheep. Eating the grass is not the problem. But he's lost sight of the shepherd. He's lost sight of the flock and his responsibilities to the shepherd and to the flock. Now sometimes we get involved in other things to the extent we neglect the things that are the most important. That's not anything new. You remember in the text of Hosea chapter 4 and verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Reading on down in that text, they were to be destroyed because they didn't understand. Do we not put ourselves in the same kind of danger because of a lack of knowledge? Because we haven't given diligence to learn the things that we need to know? We're not taking heed to those things? Now, when this man found his sheep, we have down at the bottom of this chart, it was a great occasion of rejoicing because he's found that which is lost. Now, how are you going to recover somebody that's lost without teaching? Can you do it? But you can't teach what you don't know. Can't do that. So the things you're learning tonight hopefully will be helpful to you when opportunity and time presents itself to communicate them to somebody else. Look further in this next illustration, beginning in verse 8 through verse 10. Any questions or comments about the first illustration? Second illustration. What woman having 10 pieces of silver, if she loses one piece, doth not light a lamp and sweep the house and seek diligently until she find it? And when she hath found it, she calleth together her friends and neighbors, saying, rejoice with me, for I found the piece which I had lost. Even so, I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth. Two or three things I think that are very important to us to recognize in this. This coin is out of circulation, and it's lost, it's useless, right? But it's still valuable. This woman had 10 pieces of silver. Now, sometimes we need to stop and try to count money. And I've read things that, and you have too, where they've tried to give a current equivalent to the amount of a piece of money that we might read about either in the Old or New Testament. And that'll be current for about the next 24 hours, and then it's no longer current. And that don't help me much. But when I began to do some reading on this, the value of this coin that she has lost, it's a piece of silver that is equivalent to the Roman denarius. And it would have the value of something in the neighborhood of a day's wages. And you just put that into the calculator and see what it'd be worth to you. And you multiply that by 10. She had 10, but here's a large chunk of what she's got that's gone. It's useless to her. Now, I'm not here to ask how much you make in a day's wage. That's not the point. But I would dare say you'd hate to just lose it. Well, this woman can't find it. It's gone. It was of great value to her. What would you do if you begin to try to pay the bills and here's a whole day's wage that's gone? Well, she lighted a lamp. And she swept the house diligently. She's looking like this man did for his sheep, because it is of great value to her. And she searched diligently, not for just a little while, but she searched until she had found it. Now when she found it, she called together her friends and neighbors and said, rejoice with me, I found the piece which I had lost. Would you not have occasion to rejoice? Well, let me just use a crude illustration. You ever get ready to go somewhere and perhaps you're loading up your pockets and you can't find your wallet? Ever done that? Never done that. Well, let's say you can't find your keys. You ever done that? Never done that either. Oh, Richard, I'm asking the wrong fella. He's so organized. We get kind of excited. I do. I put my keys in my left pocket when I get ready. And I search the house diligently for a long time, enough to be incredibly frustrated. You know where I found my keys? There's only two or three places that I keep my keys because I don't want to lose them. I found them in my right pocket. I had picked them up and put them in my right pocket. Didn't remember doing that, but that's where they were. Now, when you're trying to get ready to go somewhere, your car keys are valuable to you, are they not? Well, you can't go without them. So what do? You search diligently until you find them.
this woman and this shepherd realized the value of that which was lost. And I'll tell you, though I was embarrassed when I found my car keys, I said to Donna, I found my car keys. This is a wonderful thing. I found my car keys. Can you imagine what it would be when you consider the value of a soul? You see, that's what Jesus is concerned about, and that's what the Pharisees and scribes are fussing about. Even so, I say unto you, there is joy in the presence of the angels of God over one sinner that repenteth. The value of one soul. What was it the Lord said about a man who gains the whole world and loses his own soul? You see, the point being is, your soul's worth more than everything, all combined as far as material value is concerned. Now, this lost coin, kind of like that sheep, don't have a brain. I'm not saying the sheep didn't have a brain. Not the brightest Crayola in the box. But this coin, it didn't know it was lost. Had no ability to reason or to find its way back into the woman's pocket. But it was up to the woman to find that which was lost. And that's the point. How many times have you tried to teach somebody that did not realize they were lost? Not easy, is it? And that's the point. Jesus was associating with these that were lost so he could teach them. Not an easy task. Now, moving on to that, let's talk about this prodigal, beginning in verse 11. And he said, a certain man had two sons, and the younger of them said to his father, Father, give me the portion of thy substance that falleth to me. And he divided unto them his living. And not many days after, the younger son gathered all together and took his journey into a far country, and there he wasted his substance with riotous living. And when he had spent all, there arose a mighty famine in that country, and he began to be in want. And he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into the fields to feed swine. And he would fain have filled his belly with the husk that the swine did eat, and no man gave unto him. Let's pause there in the reading. This certain man, some again want to speculate, was this a real person that had two? No, this is an illustration. Likely could be described as a parable, like the other two illustrations that Jesus has offered. There may be many details that we don't know about this illustration. But a certain man had two sons. And the younger of them wanted his inheritance. You ever know a family that gets into trouble over the inheritance? Why would you suppose a young fellow would come to his daddy and demand his inheritance? I want my inheritance. I want it now. Is he thinking about dear old daddy? Is he thinking about anybody else in the family? No, he's thinking about himself and what he wants to do. Now, you underscore, when you're talking about the prodigal son at this point, you're talking about somebody that's selfish, willful, stubborn. Is that pretty close to right? Selfish, willful, and stubborn. Now, when he goes into a far country, he goes with the idea that what I want to do is better than what I had. I'll live it up and I'll have a real good time. Let me make this remark to you, and if you want to comment, I'd appreciate it. Sin is deceptive. It often promises things that it can't deliver. It has an allurement to it, like this young man thought he would find in the world. And he thought, with his pockets full of money, he could satisfy what the world promised him. But you know, sometimes there are a lot of things in the world that it has promised that it not only cannot deliver on, but there are some surprises along the way that you didn't expect, like this famine. Hadn't planned on that. There are some characters here that, of course, we want to talk about. We want to talk about the merciful father. We want to talk about the prodigal, the wasteful son. And then we want to talk about that elder brother. But Jesus is stressing in this account the loving father, his care for that which is lost. And both of these brothers, their selfish interest in the inheritance. Neither one of them are thinking about the father, and neither one of them are thinking about the most valuable thing they have, their soul. Not concerned about that. So this young man, he takes his part of the inheritance and he goes into a far country. Now, some things we want to note about that. when it tells us that the Father divided his substance among these brothers, we might say, well, that's premature. The dad's not dead. That's not the point. The point is, he's divided the inheritance. The younger brother's got his now. The older brother will get what's left. That's his when dad dies. Now, that becomes overwhelmingly clear when we get to the end of the story. But you'll notice that the younger brother, in verse 13, gathered all together, which implies that it was necessary for him to liquidate what he had. We're not just talking about his father gave him a certain amount of money. He had to get things together. And then he took it, and he wasted it with riotous living. And then when he had spent all, again, an indicator that he had to liquidate what he had and turn it into money. And he went out and he had a good time. Now, there are some elements in this, I think, that make it a little bit different. Maybe you might like to tell me what you see in this that make it a little bit different from the lost sheep and the lost coin. What would make it different?
It was deliberate.
It was deliberate, yes. Yes.
He made a choice. And the lost coin that you said, it was just mislaid. He was not. And the sheep wandered off without being, you know, aware that he was away from the shepherd. So this boy left deliberately.
He did. Both eyes open. He went out into the world, decision of his own. Susan?
It's just the first two were things, and the third one is the person.
All right.
It's not the same.
It's not the same at all. No.
It's that it's somebody had a frame of mind to do that. It's made the image of God. He makes a decision to have a chance of free will.
All right.
And the other two do not.
All right. There's another element in this equation, too, that I think makes it different, and that is this young fellow's decision affects other people. It's a willful decision, but it affects relationships. It affects other people, his father, his brother. He's made this decision independent of the thinking of anybody else. This is what he wants to do. Selfish, like you pointed out. Willful, deliberate decision. And that's different from these other things. And I would dare say that most of us, though we've lost things that were of value to us, we've had some rupture in relationships that hurt a lot worse.
The other thing is, the younger son didn't just leave home and try and make a living on his own. It says he squandered his things, his living. And the brother says, he's devoured your wealth with prostitutes. So he intentionally left home in order to have a sinful life.
Yeah, yeah. He went out to live it up. Now, whether he had spent it all on prostitutes or not, that's his brother's interpretation of what he's done. Yeah, we don't know that.
But it says he squandered his estate of loose living.
Yeah, and that he has. And now his friends are all gone, and there's a famine in the country. The text tells us that he came to be in want. Now, does he know the condition that he's in? Is he lost? Yeah. Does he know he's lost? He does now.
He finally had a light bulb moment.
He did have a light bulb moment. Yes, he certainly did. Now, he's made some awful, awful decisions in his life. But the text tells us, as we go on before I get to that, verses 15 and 16, he went and joined himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. Here's an element that sometimes is, I think, overlooked in this study. When he went into a far country, he's no longer associating among Jews. Now, we know that's so because he went into this fellow's field to feed pigs. Jews wouldn't have owned pigs. Why not? Unclean. Jews wouldn't have owned pigs. They wouldn't eat pigs. They wouldn't own pigs. They wouldn't have anything to do with pigs. And now here, presumably, this young man is a Jew, and he's out here in the world in association with those who are Gentiles doing the most demeaning task that a Jew could do, and that is having something to do with pigs.
No, your comment, I think you address this in a later slide. So he says, talking about the three people in the story here, he says the father didn't go out after him.
No, he did not. We're going to have to take a moment and look at that. I hope we have time to talk about the Father in this equation. But you're right. Two things. The Father didn't go look for him. And I searched diligently in this to see an indicator, and I haven't found an idea how long the boy was gone. I don't know how long he was gone. But he was gone long enough to run through the Father's money.
Well, and evidently the Father was still working. He had hired men.
Yes, he did.
He was doing his job and working with the Son.
Well, that's right. And one of the things that we want to note in this as well is not only is he lost willfully, as Linda has pointed out, other things we could talk about, but being in this pig pen, it tells us that no man gave unto him. Now the implication, I think, of that, and certainly it's clear that even the Gentile pig farmer didn't help him. He's on his own. The Bible tells us here in this text that he was so hungry that he would have filled his belly with the husk that the swine did eat. Now the passage doesn't tell us that that's what he did, but it tells us that's how hungry he was. Now, you can study about what those pods were and how they were used and all that kind of stuff about feeding the pigs. We didn't have the pods and such that's peculiar to this text. But we fed our pigs corn. Sometimes it was on the cob, sometimes it was off the cob. Sometimes the shucks were on, sometimes the shucks were not on. But pigs eat anything, for the most part. And to imagine oneself being in such a predicament that here is a Jew and to see himself so hungry that he would be not only associated with the swine, but eating what he would feed to the swine, that hungry. He's at the bottom of the barrel. And in that state, I want you to note, verse 17, it says he came to himself. I think Noah and I, we've talked about this before and used the expression hit bottom. Would it be a correct statement to say this man has hit bottom? He came to himself. You ever have to come to yourself? What do you do when you come to yourself? We might put it this way. You come to your senses. What have you done?
Realized the error of your ways.
You've realized what an awful mess you've made. Now, in order to do that, some things have to be accomplished. Number one, you have to take a good look at yourself. This man hadn't been doing that. Oftentimes, that's where we falter. We see everybody else but me. This young man did something evidently he's never done before. He took a good, hard look at himself, and then he had to think about it. Think about where he was. Reflect on the condition that he was in. And then there's a third element involved in this. He came to a decision. You'll note he raised the question, how many hired servants of my father's, verse 17, have bread enough and to spare, and I perish here with hunger? What's he remembering? That's right. What he had at home, the way it used to be. How that even the servants, they're not starving like I am. They have bread enough. And notice the expression, and to spare. By the way, that expression is what we study Sunday night with the word abundantly, over and above. That's what the servants had. And I perish here with hunger. And here's what he said. I will, verse 18, arise and go to my father, and I will say unto him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in thy sight. See, now he's recognizing a responsibility. I have a responsibility to the God of heaven. And I also have a responsibility to my earthly father. I've sinned against God and I've sinned against my father. And so now he's made a decision. I'll go to him, tell him what I've done. I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. Verse 19, make me as one of thy hired servants. And he arose and came to his father. Now note that. It's not enough just to come to yourself. It's not enough just to reflect upon what a mess you've made. It's not enough to just simply come to a decision. You haven't improved a single thing until you've acted on that decision. And the text tells us he came to his father. Now, based on the premise of what he had experienced growing up, what he remembered, how that his father provided for even the servants above what I've got. And remembering that, his desire is to just simply go and be a servant. Verse 20 says, he arose and came to his father, but while he was yet afar off, his father saw him and was moved with compassion and ran and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said unto him, Father, I've sinned against heaven and in thy sight. I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. Some translations include the expression, make me one of thy hired servants. That's what he planned to say to his father. Let's comment just a little bit on this. We note that this prodigal
He's lost. He knows what he's done. He's reflected on it. He's sorry for what he's done. He wants to make things right. And he comes back to his father. But let's talk just a little bit about the father. We notice in this instance that the father saw him afar off. Now, I know preachers that just wax eloquent on the father seeing him afar off and got tears running down his face, and they just make that thing quite the movie. But that's not a movie. This is an illustration. Jesus is describing the father. The father is expressing compassion toward the boy. He's obviously been looking for him, no doubt. And now he looks for him and sees him coming. And again, Randy, the point being, I don't know how long he was looking for him. Don't know how long the boy was away. But the father didn't give up. And now finally, here comes the boy, and the father is moved with compassion. This is not going to be easy. You know, I think one of the things involved in somebody repenting of sin is what they think they can anticipate upon their return. You'll notice that the father does not rebuke him. He doesn't scorn him. He doesn't tell him, well, I told you so. No, he doesn't do any of that. But he had compassion, went and fell on his neck and kissed him. And the son said, I've sinned against heaven and in thy sight. I'm no more worthy to be called thy son. 5 minutes?
Yep.
All right. And then it says, but the father said unto his servants, bring forth quickly the best robe and put it on him. Put a ring on his hand and shoes on his feet and bring the fatted calf and kill it. Now, I want to suggest to you two or three things in this. Number one, Jesus in these illustrations is pointing out the value of the lost, is he not? He's pointing out the value of this lost boy. He's pointing out what the father could and couldn't do to get him to return. This boy has made a decision. And he's got to be the one that makes the decision to come back. Unlike the sheep and the coin. This boy's got to make a decision whether or not to come back. But the father's love for the boy is present whether he comes back or not. Now, something that we sometimes fail to see is an element in forgiveness. You ever have to forgive somebody if something is a big deal? At least to you. Great big deal. And you say, well, I just can't find it in my heart to forgive them. They might hurt me again. I've got to ask you this question. How did this father know that this boy wasn't going to come back and steal from him? Did he know that? How did he know he was not going to come back and try to engage in some kind of legal ramification and try to take what inheritance is left? Did he know any of that? No, that's not even mentioned. But it does tell us that the father ordered that the fatted calf be killed and it's time to make merry. Why? Because the father loves the boy. Don't we see that? He wants him to come back. Did you know that an element in forgiveness is making yourself vulnerable to be hurt again? Do we not think that God is vulnerable to us when he offers to us forgiveness? Who do we think is hurt by the sin that we've committed? Susan?
Well, that just is an illustration of the parent-child relationship.
Exactly.
I mean, so much of this is just reflective of, you know, God and his patience and vulnerability with us.
Exactly.
When we come back from the times that we've sinned as well.
Exactly.
He will always welcome us with open arms. And he, you know, that's just who he is.
And isn't that why Jesus is talking to the publicans and the sinners? Yeah, now we're going to see the publicans and the sinners and Jesus' love for them. And the Pharisees and the scribes and their distaste for the publicans and sinners when we get to the elder brother. All right. So here's what the father did. He didn't scold the boy. He offers forgiveness. Now keep in mind that the father's forgiveness of this boy was conditioned upon his return. And there are conditions attached to us in our return unto our heavenly father. Now, he orders that put clothes on the boy. What kind of shape do you suppose he's in? Been in the pig pen feeding pigs. Probably don't look too good. He probably lost weight. Now, maybe that's speculation, but the father changes some things. He orders that he be clothed properly. Now, there's illustration. We've been talking, we'll just use these two because they're prominent ones in some of our recent study of the book of Revelation. Well, we might tie this to it. But Revelation 3, verse 5, he who overcomes shall be clothed in white garments, and I will not blot out his name from the book of life. I counsel you to buy me, this to the church in Laodicea, buy of me gold refined by fire, that ye may be rich, and white garments, that you may be clothed. Now the Laodiceans, they thought they were wealthy, and no, they were not. They thought they had some of the finest garments that could be produced, and no, they did not.
the Lord desired that they buy of him gold and that they be clothed in white garments. Clothes make a difference. And we know that, especially for this young man returning to his father. You see, this young man is not treated as a servant, is he? It's not a come-as-you-are kind of deal. No, what did the father do with his son? The son only asked to be made a servant. What did he do to him?
Reinstated him as his son.
Reinstated him as his son. Now, in reinstating him as his son, he needed to look like his son. He put a ring on his finger. Servants didn't wear fine rings. But this boy was given a ring. And often slaves didn't wear shoes. But it was ordered that this young man have shoes to put on his feet. It was ordered that the fatted calf be killed. Now, coming off the farm, Randy, you're probably familiar with this illustration, the fatted calf. You know what you do to fatten the calf. You put him in the stall and you feed him corn or grain of some sort and you put weight on him. Now, the point being is you order that the fatted calf be killed because you've got that on reserve. In case you've got company come, you can kill the fatted calf. Indeed. This was a grand occasion. My boys come home. You kill the fatted calf. So what we want to see is the grand occasion of this boy returning that was missed by the elder brother and was certainly missed concerning the Pharisees and the scribes, as Jesus had an interest in the publicans and the sinner. Well, we'll talk about the elder brother in our next study.